radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome to radio@firehouse.com. I'm Bob Duma, your host for The Buzz on Technical Rescue. Today's show, we'll be taking a look at helicopter operations as related to technical rescue incidents. My guest today is Hank Reimer. Hank spent the last 10 years in helicopter rescue with the Los Angeles County Fire Department as a firefighter, paramedic, and crew chief. He's a member of the LA County Fire Department's Air Operations Training Cadre. He also instructs federal interagency aviation courses. As part of the federal incident management team Hank belongs to, he is a qualified air operations branch director. Hank has worked with military helicopter managers, interacting with National Guard members, as well as active duty forces. Another one of Hank's passions is speaking to various organizations on helicopter rescue, both here in the States as well as international audiences. Hank, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Today, we'll be talking about various aspects of technical rescue which benefit from the assistance of an air operations component. Just to get things started, Hank, can you kind of tell us a little bit about Los Angeles County's air operations section within the fire department?
Absolutely. We started back in 1957 with a Bell 47 and a single pilot, pretty much to do recon work, fire patrol work. They did do some water drops with that little helicopter. With a 45-gallon bladder, and also had a rack that was on the bottom of it that they used for laying hose uphill. They transitioned to more aircraft in 1967. They got their first medium helicopter, a Bell 204. In 1970, they actually put a EMS interior into a Bell 206, and they also purchased a 205, more lift capability, a medium helicopter. So it just started growing from there and hiring more personnel. In 1977, the first internal hoist was put into one of the 205s, and they started doing some testing with that, and which, of course, led into a rescue program. In 1989, we bought the first twin-engine aircraft that's in our fleet. Actually, we don't have it any longer. And it's a Bell 412. In 2001, we started a night vision goggle program and purchased the first two Firehawks that we still have in our fleet today. So going into what's going on today, we staff three multi-mission aircraft on a 24/7, 365 basis. And during certain mission profiles will augment staff. So if we have high fire danger or some impending flood and debris action where we feel we might need some more assistance, then we'll bring people in and staff more aircraft. So with that said, our air operations budget is $7.2 million. And we also have a contract air program during the fire season that we'll augment our staffing with contract air. We have a sky crane from Ericsson that we lease and two CL-415 super scoopers that come from Quebec, Canada.
Sounds like quite an impressive fleet. From talking to other members of your organization and different folks in the LA County area, sit on a couple maybe specifics of these different airframes. The Firehawk, to the civilian population or the general firefighter, what would be its counterpart that you would compare something as the Firehawk to?
The Firehawk is made by Sikorsky. They have, I believe it's 23 different versions of the Hawks. They have the Nighthawk, the Pavehawk, the Black Hawk, of course, and that would probably be what everybody would identify that aircraft with. We have three of those. They're all outfitted with an external rescue hoist, and they have a 1,000-gallon water tank fixed and a 30-gallon foam tank. And those are our three big boys. We also have four Bell 412 helicopters, twin-engine version. It's a medium helicopter, a little bit smaller. Five of those have rescue hoists attached to them. They also have 360-gallon water tanks, and they're outfitted with a 12-gallon foam tank. And then our fifth Bell 412 is actually used as a command and control platform, and it has FLIR capability for mapping, and we'll use it as a helicopter coordinator platform on large incidents where we have multiple aircraft working the same incident.
Now, you refer to some of your aircraft having twin engines. Advantages of that, obviously, you have one extra, but I know from other agencies, having worked with the Coast Guard at times on the East Coast, this providing you with overwater capabilities more so than a single engine would?
Absolutely. If you got forward flight and you got a twin engine capability, hopefully it'll take you over to a dry area where you can put it down. Definitely during a hoist situation, you want that twin engine capability. So should there be an incident, you get a hiccup, you have an engine that quits, if we can get some forward flight, we can sustain some type of altitude with a single engine capability. If that one engine quits, you're pretty much going in. So that's why we've gone to the Bell 412s, and we also do overwater stuff. So that just makes us feel a little bit more at ease when we are over water.
Most definitely. Now, these various types of aircraft you have, how do you staff them? What types of numbers would you be flying on board at any given time as far as members?
Our typical crew is two firefighter paramedics. One has got a little bit more training. Sometimes we have two, of course, together, but typically the crew chief, he'll ride in the left front seat of the aircraft, and he handles all the fire department radios and helps the pilot with transponder, GPS, so on and so forth. Can also dial up aviation frequencies if need be. The crewman in the back, of course, is primarily the downside rescuer, and would be the, I guess you could call, the patient man if we're running an EMS type mission. And then we have a pilot. So our typical crew is three persons, and we staff three of those three-person crews 24 hours a day minimum.
So, and L.A. County is a very large geographic footprint, so obviously these aircraft are spotted around the community in various locations?
Absolutely. We have a central heliport where we do our crew changes at. That's where the majority of the maintenance is done, and then we deploy out to different areas of Los Angeles County, one being up into the Antelope Valley area in the northern part, and we send one out to the east end, and the third one actually will go out to the Malibu area during the day and then return to the heliport, and they spend the night at the heliport, making them a little bit more central so they can back up the other two and get around the different parts of the county at night.
Sounds like LA County is well protected, and we were speaking prior to the show starting on just the diversity of climate and topography within the community, where you can be at the beach surfing and swimming in the morning and then be at a ski resort skiing in the afternoon. So your people must be very flexible in their ability to adapt to the mission they're called upon.
Well, yeah, that's definitely a fact. Between, as I was mentioning earlier when we spoke, we could be on a beach rescue or over on Catalina Island for even a small fire or something, and then the fire season never really quits around here, and then go to go up into the mountains and end up with a snow or an ice rescue. So with that said, not only is the crew training very versed, but it's all the different equipment that we have to carry to be able to flip on a different hat at any given moment.
And that, obviously, we're dealing with a very limited space, no matter how large the particular craft you're using is. So there's got to be quite a bit of efficiency built into the operation and the logistics of what type of a cache of equipment you carry with you between the desired amount and what you actually have room for or capability of bringing with you. Does that pose you logistics challenges from time to time, or has it been around long enough to where you've kind of got that polished down?
Well, it's always an issue, especially when you're dealing with a light helicopter, which we don't have anymore, or a medium-duty helicopter, or also known as a Type 2 helicopter, which our 412s fall into that category. Between the water tank and the rescue hoist and the night sun that we have and our personal gear, plus all the different rescue adjuncts and medical gear we carry, it gets to be a bit of a challenge at times. In this day and age, everybody's coming up with new types of rescue adjuncts, and in this business, in aviation, everything's predicated on weight, altitude, and temperature. So with that said, less is more in this business. So you got to find an adjunct piece of equipment that can do numerous things versus all single mission profile type things as far as the rescue adjuncts go, all of our equipment actually.
It definitely makes sense, both from a fiscal standpoint and, in your case, both a spatial and operational standpoint. You refer to like your pilots and that on the crews. Are these individuals out of the LA County Fire Department's employ, or do you have like contract people who come in and actually operate them?
Actually, that's a great question. We have our Los Angeles City Fire Department, our brothers, so to speak. They also have a Air Force, and these are firefighters that have come up through the ranks and gone out and got their own training and have a commercial pilot's license, and then they will be picked up by the Air Operations Section and they further train them. Our pilots come from the commercial and the utility world, where they just to test with us, they have to have a minimum of 4,000 hours. 1,500 of those hours have to be working above 4,000 feet, and they prefer them to have some firefighting, some EMS experience, and definitely some night experience as well. So that's the main difference with us. So most of our guys are coming to us with well above 10,000 hours. It's a highly desired job in the commercial helicopter pilot industry. And so we've done quite well with the experienced personnel that we've gotten to drive our airplane, so to speak.
It sounds like a very positive combination. Your top-level pilots working with top-level crew members, putting on a team that's bringing quite a service to the community and obviously available to others when needed in a mutual aid type of situation. Some of the different missions you've been called upon, any one or a few that jump to the front of your head as far as memorable?
Well, our missions basically break into four different areas, and I'll start with the support mission. We do searches. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Aero Bureau, they do not work in the mountains at night, so if there's a lost hiker to be looked for, or even law enforcement type things, that we're the ones that'll be up there working in the mountains at night. So we do a lot of searches. Reconnaissance work, obviously, you heard about all the flooding after the station fire that we had, and so we'll take people up from power and water or some of our command staff to go look at these areas and survey the areas. Evacuations, if there's no way of getting ground folks in there, we'll get involved in that. We also have forward-looking infrared capability, and we'll do mapping for fires just to get the acreage, things like that. And for control burns, we have a couple different pieces of apparatus that can actually put fire down to do control burns for training as well as for weed abatement issues. So that's the support end of it. On the emergency medical services end of it, we support the trauma system. There's two areas within the county that, especially with the traffic that we have in Los Angeles County, it's impossible for the ground guys to get to the trauma centers within a 30-minute window. So we come into play and support the trauma system there. Occasionally, we do medicals if we can get there quicker than the ground folks. We have Catalina Island that we take care of as well, and that's about 23 miles offshore off the mainland. So they do have some paramedics over there and a very small hospital with limited expertise and staff, so we end up going over there a lot. With the coastline and the islands in the area here, not only in the ocean but also the freshwater stuff, we also have dive emergencies we deal with, and the USC has a dive chamber over on Catalina Island that will transport divers to that may be bent or ended up with a case of nitrogen narcosis and so forth. So, and occasionally, if it warrants, we will get involved in interfacility transfers, and that's a very low number. We'll do three or four of those a year. So that's the EMS end of it. The fire end, of course, we do the suppression. As I mentioned earlier, we have the belly tanks on our aircraft. And we also have a hand crew program where we insert hand crews. And these are the guys that really do all the work on these wildland incidents. And it's all with no water. It's all with hand tools and chainsaws. And we'll support the crews as they're cutting line and building fire breaks. And we also will supply a helicopter coordinator. Generally, the pilot will end up managing the aircraft, and we will have a chief officer on board as well, and he's almost like a deputy operations type person that is eye in the sky for the IC, and this program's actually worked out quite well for us. And then, of course, the fourth and probably the biggest one is the technical rescue with hoist rescue, mountain cliff rescue, water rescues, large animal extractions, and high-rise type things.
And I think these are the things that most of our listeners, especially myself from the East Coast, when we see you operating either on CNN or through a various professional publication, these are the type of activities you're usually engaged in. The impressive part is the three or four other categories you mentioned prior to this one, that just how diverse of a resource you are for everyone. You know, looking at the wildland fires and bringing the hand crews in, kind of the unsung heroes, you know, the people, like you said, get in there with their bare hands and do some significant labor without the ability of the transport capabilities you bring to them. We can see how a large operation like this could become that much more challenging. With this, when you talk about the different technical rescues, you know, hoist rescues, kind of give us a little bit more background on what exactly is entailed there and, you know, how that benefits an incident.
Well, you know, let's go back here a little bit. A well-known helicopter pioneer by the name of Igor Sikorsky, who developed some of the first helicopters, and still they have a huge program going, and we have three of their aircraft. He said many years ago, he said, if a man is in need of rescue, an airplane can come in and throw flowers on him. And that's about all. But a direct lift aircraft could come in and save his life. Now, the first civilian hoist rescue was done quite some time ago, November 29th in 1945, off of Fairfield, Connecticut. And that was done with a Sikorsky R-3. And it was truly the precursor for many thousands of similar missions that worldwide that are being conducted to date. Now, as far as the hoist itself goes, it's kind of interesting, especially when I first got involved 10 years ago, that all the equipment tied to the hoist, and it goes right down to the most intricate piece on your harness, but the harness and the screw links and the hook itself, the wire rope that we're using, that's all rated way more than the actual structural limitation of the aircraft. So that's where our limitations are. And they're set at 600 pounds for medium and heavy aircraft. So the mil-spec on the wire rope is actually 3,300 pounds. And the hook is rated, that we hang from, is rated at 8,000 pounds plus. So, and of course, the harnesses, different companies build those, but they're all NFPA approved.
Your safety margins obviously are equal to or greater than any of the other standards we would deal with on a daily basis for technical rescue, and utilizing, as you referred to, as the NFPA standards for the harnesses and the equipment that the individuals use, kind of brings everything together that, you know, you're providing a very unique presence in the rescue field, but safety is still job one, you know, and it's always good to see that as you bring different talents to the table, we all focus on the primary mission, and that's, you know, the safety of the rescuers and the people doing the work.
Well, you know, so, this is a totally different game than living in a fire station, and other than you getting your paycheck and your badge still says firefighter, it's a completely different mission, and not taken away from any of the other specialties within the fire service, but you're only working with three guys here and everybody has a specific job, and things can go south really quick, and there's not a whole bunch of people around to help you. So safety is huge. And with that said, as is our training, and not only the initial training, but recurrent training and so on. So yeah, it's probably the best job in the fire service, and I'm sure I have a jaded attitude towards that, but you got to be on your game.
And it sounds like very similar to other aspects, but once again, a small, tight-knit community that works well to motivate and promote each other's capabilities. You just referenced a little bit about training. Once an individual becomes a crew member or is accepted to become one and has yet to taken any flights, how much additional training is required of this individual?
Well, once they get a spot in our unit, they go through a two-week crew member training program, which just some of the things that we deal with, obviously aircraft safety, crew resource management. Like I mentioned earlier, there's only three of us in the aircraft, and everybody has to have an idea what the other person's doing, as well as play well with others, so to speak. Communications in the aircraft, completely different than what you would find in a fire engine or a truck company. So that's something else. Flight physiology, of course, with the different altitudes, the human body changes, and that's something that the guys on the ground really don't deal with because they're not involved in that stuff. Overwater flights, ditching procedures, the use of helicopter emergency egress devices, which is like a baby SCBA bottle that you can breathe if you end up. And then, of course, then we get into the technical rescue end of it with being able to don your harness and be safe in the middle of the night in the back of the aircraft. We could be coming back from one mission and be sent to a over the side somewhere. And so these guys, they have to be able to get into their harness and be ready to go. Rappel procedures, pickoff procedures, the swift water, all those things. So it's a lot of stuff that's packed into a two-week program, just enough to get their feet wet, and then we move on and massage them and mentor them. And once they get comfortable, then we'll start doing some training and get them up into the topside or crew chief level.
So a very well laid out program, and taking somebody step by step, it builds that confidence as well, so that they are now a viable asset to the operation instead of a liability. And having a small working group, it's nice to see that the focus is on understanding everyone's capabilities, so that you can enhance and assist each other as the need arises. As we look further into this, you listed a pretty good group of individually unique rescue situations you're called into, some one after another, others on a less frequent basis. Yesterday, we had the pleasure of talking to some folks from down in the San Diego area about a cliff rescue, and they referenced helicopter support from the San Diego area. Going to something as a mountain or a cliff rescue, in their case along the shoreline, what would be your focal point as a crew member coming in? What would be the traditional or typical request from your unit for assistance in these types of rescues?
Well, of course, the main purpose is to be able to take care of business a little quicker, and so with the mountainous terrain and stuff we have, and just the Angeles National Forest alone has got over 5,000 miles of hiking trails, so to get some ground people up there could take a long time, and we can actually come in there and affect the rescue in a lot shorter timeline, which would leave all the ground resources available for other calls. With vehicle over the sides or fall victims that have gone down 200-300 feet, as you well know, it takes a long time to set up a rope system and to get people down there and to properly package the patient and then to get them up. So that we can come in and have a quick look and talk to the incident commander on a tactical frequency and just go to work and really take care of business in a matter of minutes versus hours and hours of having the local people and plus the rescue folks tied up.
And time is of essence in these situations, the ability to cover as many square miles in the air. Also, I'm assuming with the lighting capabilities and that you bring with the aircraft too is probably a great aid in a remote area. It's not as easy as bringing a truck in with a light unit on it when you're remote. So there's so many different points of benefit that you're going to bring to the scene to assist those folks who do have to work there on the ground. What type of illumination or what type of lighting aid do these helicopters bring to the game?
Well, we have a 500,000 candle power night sun that we can actually focus into a wide flood type light or into pencil beam with a direct spotlight. All three crew members are also on night vision goggles. So, and this has really increased our night hoist because we're finding people on searches a lot easier now. Just the face light on a cell phone can be seen from miles away. So we're now everybody's got a cell phone, and we are actually finding these people much more than we were before the night vision goggles. With that said, of course, our the hoists go up, and we're using the night vision at night, so our night hoists are up. So 65 to 70% of our hoist rescues are actually done at night.
Well, it sounds like another example in the fire service where technology has really benefited us over the last few years, especially in the area of night vision in this case, where in the past you were a great service that had more constraints and limitations, where now we see in this one specific area how much more it even brings to the table. So the justification and the viability of having this type of service available for a community like Los Angeles County is even more important to the people that you serve.
Absolutely. And over the years, it's like anything new with the fire service. You know, people are kind of stand back and want to see it happen, and they're unsure about it. And as over the years, as we've proved ourselves that we can go in there and put these guys available quicker, take care of business and get out, and the incident concludes, I think the trust level of the firefighters on the ground that aren't as familiar with their operations, obviously, as we are, they're seeing a lot more of a benefit than they were in the past. You know, truly the helicopters and the fire service were initially started just to put the wet stuff on the red stuff. And now, even though that's still one of our primary missions, the rescue business has definitely increased tenfold over the last few years. Mm-hmm.
And, especially when you look at the popularity of the L.A. County region for tourism and people to come from different parts of the country or the world to visit and wanting to take advantage of the various places, the waterfront, the many miles of hiking trails, things of that nature. So you have a constantly dynamic and flowing audience of potential clients coming in and out of your community, plus the local residents on a daily basis. So I definitely see this as something you'll never run out of potential places to respond to or people to respond for. With this in the same area of the mountain and cliff rescue, what just in general type of frequency for these types of calls?
Well, if you look at the mountain and the cliff end of our technical program, a lot of people don't realize that we have two different mountain ranges within Los Angeles County. We have the Santa Monica Mountains out in the west end of the county, a little over 155,000 acres, and a lot of cliffs and creeks and stuff where people go hiking, and of course they'll climb up without an issue, and then all of a sudden it's time to get down, and they're stuck. So as I mentioned earlier, they have their cell phones, and sometimes we refer to it as the moron factor, where they're not prepared for what's coming, and we'll get involved there. Highest peak in the Santa Monica Mountains is actually at 3,111 feet. Now, going back into the central end of the county that runs all the way to the east is the San Gabriel Mountains. We have 12 peaks over 8,000 feet, with the highest being 10,064 feet. So with that said, you can just imagine with the snow and ice issues, we have skiers going out of bounds that they're not going to start looking for, of course, till dark. And so the missions don't actually change over the year, but the mission profile changes. So our call volume doesn't really alter throughout the year. It's just the with the winds, of course, we're going to have the fire issues. With the rains, we're going to have the swift water issues. You know, we have over 500 miles of open waterways in Los Angeles County, and people for some reason are just attracted to this stuff. And decide to go for a swim, and then they can't get out. So if the ground guys can't get in, that's, of course, when we get involved, and we'll put a rescue swimmer down and try and snatch them. And, again, it puts our ground guys available that much quicker. You mentioned with the beachfront, you know, we also have we cover 72 miles of oceanfront in the county of Los Angeles. And so we have potential of not only a lot of beach-type rescues, but also Los Angeles International Airport. The main runways, they take off directly over the ocean. So that's another consideration, and we drill on that, is a plane into the water. So we have our lifeguard section, as well as we'd be inserting rescue swimmers and doing multiple picks. We have the baskets, very similar to what the Coast Guard uses, and just a different... different mission, all within the same program.
When you were referring earlier to the water rescue component, which you touched a little bit on, two different variations you referred to, swift water rescue and then blue water rescue. Maybe you could expand a little bit on that and kind of give us some background on how one relates to the other, or how they're different from one another.
Well, they are very much different, and swift water, for the most part, you're looking at fresh water type incidents. Like I mentioned, we have over 500 miles of open waterways throughout the county, and with it being kind of a desert type area, the water just runs when it rains. And if we get an inch of rain, we got these waterways are just flowing hard and fast, and even if it's not very deep, it's hard for people to stand up in it just because of the huge volume of water that's going down. So, of course, we have our river and flood technicians that'll go out and try and affect these things by ground. And we'll also dispatch an aircraft with a rescue swimmer on board. And with that said, if they can't grab them by ground, we'll set up and wait for them downstream or downriver, and put the rescuer in the water. He stays attached to the cable, and if everything works according to plan, then he'll snatch him up, and we'll just bump him over and give him to the ground guys to take care of, and then we're ready to go on the next one. So that's kind of the swift water component. We also we get a lot of flooding up there. Like I said, if there aren't the waterways for the water to be channeled to, we'll get a lot of flooding, especially up in the Antelope Valley in the high desert. We had one of our crews a number of years ago that we had severe flooding, big rains, severe flooding, and one helicopter, they did 30 picks, and it was all at night, and it was in one shift. So, and that's just people getting stranded that couldn't get anywhere on the roofs of their cars and so on. That's kind of the swift water component there. And there's two types of programs that we run. Of course, we have the ground guys. We have what's called a tethered swimmer, where we insert the rescuer from the aircraft. He stays attached to the rope, to the wire rope, and then we can bring him back into the aircraft with the victim, or just short haul him, bump him over, and drop the victim off. The other one would be if the swimmer's actually free, and we just kind of change our program a little bit. But again, we'll lower a capture ball to him, and he'll have his victim snap the victim into the capture ball as well as himself, and then we'll bring him either into the cabin or off to the side. With the blue water component, generally we're talking about offshore, and this will be in concert with the Coast Guard, and we will insert rescue swimmers with the cans, as well as some inflatable boats to be able to try and get the people in. And once we got the rescue swimmers inserted, we can in turn turn around, come back, and start putting in a basket to bring them into the aircraft, and then bump them over to land, you know, once we start filling up the cabin, so to speak, and go back for more while we're waiting for the boats to come out, the different lifeguard agencies and the fire boats and so on.
So it's definitely a very diverse operation, and as you referenced earlier, having the flexibility to adapt to the moment and to bring the talent on. When you reference the rescue swimmers, would these be specialized individuals you would add to a crew for that mission?
Absolutely. When we're expecting rains and any kind of flooding, we have a component of people that are specially trained in that area, and we will add those to the aircraft. Because of the weather and stuff, we want to keep one guy in the left front seat to help the pilot with the radials and more eyes in the sky, so to speak. And then the guy in the back will be the topside operator and handling the hoist work and taking care of the actual rescue mission. One thing I did want to mention, going back to the hoist rescue end of it, is that, and you kind of brought it out, that we kind of work as a team. What a lot of people don't realize is that in utility work, pilots, they are actually looking out the window, or they have a door off, and they're grabbing logs or setting poles, whatever it is they do. The way the hoist rescues work is because that cable is so close to the skids, the pilot can't see what's going on underneath them. So he is totally needing the crew chief to move the aircraft around. So it's a bit of a dance. The crew chief is lowering the rescuer to the bottom and making sure we're not dragging him through the trees and on the ground into rocks, as well as moving the aircraft. And the pilot, of course, has to have a lot of trust in the crew chief that he doesn't run the main rotor disc into rocks or trees. So it's a very it's a tight dance.
So that synergy between the crew really starts to show the importance of being familiar with one another, and that confidence that if you're the pilot, that your crew working with you isn't going to put you in harm's way, and they're going to provide everybody involved with a safe working platform. So a small three-person crew can actually be very dynamic when you start to put all the pieces of the puzzle together and what's the, you know, needed from each individual to make this thing actually successful. Talked a little bit about animal extraction. You know, never having been involved with that in a helicopter aspect of things, seeing it done with hoisting systems and rigging systems and a ground-based, animals caught in mud, things of that nature. In my mind, I picture these being very large and heavy animals. How does that impact your capabilities when you're called upon this type of an event?
Well, first of all, as I mentioned quite early in the program here, the hoist is rated, and it's a structural component of not the hoist itself, but of the aircraft that the hoist is mounted to at 600 pounds. So obviously, if we have a horse or something we have to take out of a canyon, that's not going to work. So we will drop the tank on the aircraft, and we will go to the cargo hook with a large line and come off the belly of the aircraft. So we have a lot higher weight capability. Now, going back in a little bit of history here in Los Angeles County, we weren't involved in large animal rescues up till probably about 8-9 years ago. LA City, together with the animal control people, they kind of took care of most of that, and it was called the Farm Animal Rescue Team, acronym of FART. So of course they didn't enjoy that too much, and we kind of moved on from there. There was a grant written by somebody in our department that actually got us involved and purchased some Anderson harnesses. They were developed up in Northern California with a veterinarian at a university, along with a Mr. Anderson. I can't for the life of me remember his first name, and he's since passed, but his son-in-law actually runs the business now. They have three different harnesses for three different size type animals, and so we started training together with the animal control people, and our rescue trucks actually carry the Anderson harness, so they're well versed. This is a long drawn out process, these animal extractions, but a lot of these animals are high dollar animals, so you have to have a packaging team with a vet on that end. You have to have a receiving team with a vet on the other end. They do give the animal a sedative, and they have to counteract that sedative in a very short period of time at the other end, otherwise they're going to lose the animal. So We don't do a lot of these, but it's definitely something we train at. We probably do 4 or 5 of these a year. I had one personally last, I think it was July, maybe early August. We were up at over 8,000 feet, and it was the first time that we'd used one of our Firehawks for that mission. We actually dropped the tank and went up there and took probably about a 1,400-pound horse out of there. Now, it was getting dark, and it was close to nightfall, so we ended up hoisting out after we put the horse got the horse down to the receiving team. Then we got rid of our long line, and we went back, and I actually hoisted out 8 people from the mountaintop. Otherwise, they would have been wandering around up in the mountains trying to get back at night. So it was just something that made sense. A lot of people that aren't very familiar with helicopter-type programs, they feel that the risk versus gain, it's a lot more risk than gain, but if you practice like you play, you're going to play like you practice, and just the sheer issue of having the time component there where these people can go back in service and you put them available, that in itself will take care of business.
I agree, and coming from the Northeast with ice and freezing conditions, when you start talking about animal rescue, be it large or medium size, it also falls back on if we in the fire or the rescue community don't provide the service, the owner or the Good Samaritan's going to. So that could be your next mission if you didn't go in and effect a safe retrieval of the animal of any size. The next call will be the individual who tried on their own and now becomes entrapped or has a negative situation. We look at it in the ice rescue forum where a dog, a deer, something out on the ice doesn't have a high price value in the general public's eyes, but sentimental value will bring a very, you know, what would be a typically intellectual adult out onto that bad platform. So you're definitely providing both a service to the community, but a safety enhancement by being able to mitigate these situations in a way that may not be possible without your assistance.
You know, it's interesting you said that, Bob, and here, it's probably about a month and a half ago, and this made international news, was our LA City brothers went in, and they took a lot of heat for doing that dog rescue, and where that crewman got bit, and probably would have got bit a lot worse if he didn't have a helmet on. But there again, as what you just brought up, if nobody would have done anything, then there would have been some do-gooder, some Good Samaritan, or 4 or 5 that would have gotten in that channel to go try and help that dog. And so then they're getting involved with dealing with the humans there. So either way, they would have been under the gun either way that thing went. So they probably did the right thing by just going in there, getting that dog. You know, everything in the L.A. Basin is the media gets there most of the time before we do. Don't ask me how that works. They got, there's probably 6 or 7 news helicopters plus fixed-wing aircraft. So anything we do, especially if we make a mistake, it's going to be all over the world very quickly.
And I recall that incident you referenced to specifically, and it did make the news everywhere, and reading it in different publications and on the television news media, hearing about it, the impressive thing was how the company officer, the individual in charge of that incident, responded and very much echoed what you just covered, that, you know, they have to make a decision. They're there to provide a service. And I think it's another aspect of just the world we live in today. There, no matter how good you do your job, there's always going to be somebody challenging it or having a secondary opinion. But the fact that they made a positive decision, everything came out well, it showed a very high level of professionalism on their part, and they took this to the next level. And in the long run, these moments come and go, and we're off to the next incident. So we can't utilize them as heavy baggage. We just have to deal with it and move forward. One of the other areas you touched on when we were talking earlier is high rise. Most people in communities that don't have the luxury of an air operations unit, such as LA County and some of the very few other parts of the country who do, are the only real taker from major motion pictures where the towering inferno is burning and all of a sudden a helicopter swoops in and very simply just picks somebody off and on to the next activity. probably not quite that easy in reality.
Well, you know, having a helicopter, or as Igor Sikorsky put it, direct lift aircraft definitely gives you some advantages. The traditional way of fighting a high-rise fire is everybody's coming from the bottom and going up. And we're all taught not to use the elevators, and now we're trucking bottles and hose and all our equipment up hundreds of flights of stairs. What we started a number of years ago with our rescue boys is that we will pick them up and we will insert them on the rooftop, and then they can actually make access from the top down. A couple different trains of thought on that. You can rappel everybody in, but again, there's keeping that everybody hovering, and the exposure is heightened. The other way would be to rappel one guy in. He drops all the towers, antennas, and so forth, and we can come in and do either a one skid or a one wheel landing, and then kick these guys out. They're not using a traditional breathing apparatus. They're using a rebreathing apparatus that gives them about 2 hours of air. They also have their own rope, which is a 300 footer. So should they be caught somewhere, they can actually deploy that rope and rappel down to the bottom. Well, as long as it's not over 30 stories, I guess. And they actually go in with bags of equipment. So they're going in there with saws. They're going in there with axes. And so that's a one part of the Hilo high-rise that we can affect having aircraft. And I mean, we, like I mentioned earlier, we have three aircraft that we can have pretty much anywhere in the county within 20 minutes. So and then we, of course, have the LA City guys that we can call on to help us out as well. The other part of the Hilo high-rise is the evacuation and extraction. And again, if you can get the towers down and come in there and put either one skid or one wheel on, it's a lot easier to start loading people in and then just pull off and go drop them somewhere and come back and do it again. There's other systems, many companies out there making slings, and there's a spider rig that has a hasty harness, and there's six straps that come off of there so they can take six people at a time. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, with having that 600-pound hoist rating, this is going to have to be off a belly hook and do a short haul. So having the helicopters definitely in a high-rise situation, not only putting people in but being able to evacuate people out, just makes life that much easier for the guys doing all the hard work and fighting the fire.
And I think as a traditional ground-based firefighter throughout my career, if you're put into a situation to have to work in one of these environments, high-rise in this case, I think it also adds a little bit of a psychological security to you as the firefighter, knowing that there's another arm of the operation out there to help you if you do get into a negative situation, that you know, you don't always have to worry about making it back to the bottom if the top is the only place you can go to. In your case, with the availability of your lift systems, firefighter gets trapped, makes it to the roof. Now there is an actual, you know, arm of assistance available through you folks in the helicopters to get them out of harm's way. So once again, the safety aspect just comes right back into the program. You know, every time we look at something, we could always, you know, take that turn and reference back to that one key point of both the safety of you, the individuals on the helicopter, but all of the workforce and the civilians that you're out there supporting. So it's a big tool that obviously in a community as highly populated and as densely populated as yours is, probably very well appreciated by many of the folks who do work on the ground on a daily basis.
Well, you know, we're just another component of the big picture, and like I said, I have a bit of a jaded interest, and I think it's the best gig going in the fire service, but we are just one small component. You know, we have over 10 million people in the L.A. Basin. We're responsible for about 4.5 million. And besides having the unincorporated areas, we also do the state responsibility areas. And we have 59 contract cities that we supply fire service for. So there's we have a big area. You know, I mentioned Catalina earlier. there's not a lot of residents on Catalina. There's only a little over 4,000 full-time residents, but it's a huge draw, especially in the summertime for visitors. So between boating accidents and everything else, of course, we have our fire guys over there and our lifeguard component, and we're just another component to help take care of business in the big picture.
And, you know, I think as we start leading into our wrap-up here, we've kind of identified, you know, one small component of the overall L.A. County Fire Department's operational capabilities, but a very diverse one at that. You know, Hank, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. Actually, I'd like to get together sometime in the future. Another area that's very much in the conversational points is wildland firefighting, things of that nature. Through your capabilities and background as an air operations branch director in the incident management system, I think it would be very interesting to our listeners to sit down, talk about the different components and services and capabilities you bring into that position for some future conversations. Once again, you know, want to thank you so much for bringing all the information, insight, and background you have in this field, you know, to the show today. Any closing thoughts or things on your mind?
No, I just I appreciate the opportunity to come and share a little bit about our program, and we really didn't get very specific. It was more of a overall look at an air operations program and all the multi-mission programs, San Diego's, LA City's, Santa Barbara, Ventura's, and along the California area here. They're pretty much the same. And I just, again, I want to thank you for the opportunity of inviting me, and I'd love to sit down with you again sometime.
Thank you very much. And this is your host, Bob Dumel, for the Buzz on Technical Rescue. Thank you for listening, and have a safe day.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.